Welcome to the Veritas Podcast. For even more exciting content, visit our website at www.veritaswbc.com. Enjoy the podcast.
Tonight, what I want to do is focus on some of the things that I think are going on as to, in terms of why it is that God allows the amount of evil and the kinds of evil that you see in the world. You know, bearing in mind some of the background that we talked about last week, that evil and suffering are not the same thing. It's important to remember that. But instead, when we talk about evil, we're really talking about, you know, things not being the way that they ought to be. Evil itself is not like a thing, but it's a privation of a good. It's a lack in something that ought to be a different way, much like when you think of like rust on a car. It requires metal, but the rust is what's the problem. It takes away from the nature of the thing. And that's what it is that we really mean when we're talking about evil. Suffering, though, is completely different. You know, we gave the example last week. If you think of a murderer that's put in prison, no doubt there's suffering that's in prison, but we wouldn't say that it's evil that they're in prison, right? In fact, we would say that a lack of justice would be an evil. And so that's why I said we can't treat these two things as the same thing. But here's the question. Some of the things that were brought up during the course of the week last week and even throughout the week from Sunday to today, last Sunday to today, is the question, why doesn't God just stop evil? You know, there was a book, Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? And Harold Kushner, after suffering a tragedy in his family, came to the conclusion that God just must not be able, isn't perfect. And as a result of his limitations, he couldn't have stopped it from coming. You know, we ask these questions, you know, why doesn't God stop Hitler in like 1939 or something like that, right? Give him cancer and he dies, or, you know, just snap his fingers and make his heart stop. And on an emotional level, I totally understand why we're asking those questions. I really do. However, we're also talking about how it is that God makes choices in the way that he governs not just an instance, but actually the whole cosmos. One of the things I want us to keep in mind is this. For God to stop evil requires the elimination of the capacity of our free choice. Think about it. For God to stop evil requires the elimination of our capacity for free choice. But the elimination of our free choice would mean that we would not be capable of experiencing the greatest good, which is the love of God. Does that make sense? It's an important place to start. It's by no means the only thing that I have to say. But for God to stop us from having the capability of experiencing the greatest good, which is to know and to love him, would be the greatest evil. For him to remove that capacity would be the greatest evil. So we would really have this question, and I'm just kind of building on something we talked about last week, but we really would have to ask this question, do we want God to eliminate our free will? That would be the question. There are a lot of byproducts of our willing, if you think about it. One of the questions that was asked last week really had to do with the issue of climate change. And I didn't want to get off into the weeds of whether or not, you know, that's true, if it's scientifically verified. I didn't want to worry about that. Instead, I just wanted to take the question at face value and say this. All right, let's say for the sake of argument that climate change is real and that we've had our place in it, because that's really, really what it's about, right? What that would show is that there is a balance in nature, and the choices that we make should be connecting to the good of nature itself. We have been given that charge in Genesis, if you think about it, when God creates and he says you're to have and exercise dominion over creation. That doesn't mean we're to exercise power or control. It's that we were to exercise responsibility and care. That was the challenge that was given to us. So it's far from clear to me if we just take that line of questioning and say, okay, see how the issue of free will is connecting to some things here, including what could be like what we would often describe as natural evils that happen in the world. Now, again, I don't want to say that free will is everything. What I'm trying to say is that free will is something. It's an important factor in the conversation. If you look at Luke 13, and I'm just going to talk about it, but I invite you to write this, kind of scribble this in your notes, and then maybe during the course of the week, go and check this out. But in Luke 13, it records a verbal exchange between Jesus and a small group of people who approached him, and they're inquiring about the slaughter of innocent people at the hands of Pilate. Some of you might remember that. And they also wondered about a tragic event involving a tower that had fallen and had killed 18 people. Jesus responds, but he responds not in the way that they expected. It's kind of the way I expect him to respond if I'm just reading the Bible. You know, here's what he does. He doesn't explain why the events occur, much like if you read Job. That's why I say if you go to Job, you're not going to get a theodicy. You're not going to get an effort to justify the ways of God in the light of tremendous suffering from this guy. Jesus is no different. He doesn't explain why the events occurred. Instead, he redirects the question back to the questioners. Some would say that he's Socratic with them. But he decides to ask them some questions. And his comments to them imply, you know, a warning concerning the impending danger they face if they did not acknowledge and address the evil in their own heart. In their own hearts. So here's basically what he says. Does the evil out there in the world really disturb you? Because remember, at every turn, somebody's trying to, like, you know, snag Jesus or kind of give him these gotcha kind of questions. And instead he responds with a question, right? Does evil out there really, really disturb you? So if you're troubled by evil, then start with the evil that's the very closest to you. And it's the evil in yourself. Teaching moment, right? But it's a fair thing to say. I'm worried about everything that's out there. Are you really? Are you worried about everything that's in there? So what's the purpose of evil and suffering? I do want to shift to that, because when Rabbi Harold Kushner concluded that God is imperfect, he assumed a standard of perfection, by the way, that he's measuring God up against and saying, you know, God kind of dropped the ball there. I want to make just a few suggestions to you tonight, because I do want to devote a lot of time to our Q&A. I know you have a lot on your mind, and I'd like to get to that here in a little bit, but I want to make some important distinctions, because when we're asking God why certain things happen, and why there's the amount of evil that there is in the world, which I'm going to be honest, I've asked. You know, as a kid, I wondered why it was that I had not just asthma, but the severity of the asthma that I had. I mean, it nearly killed me several times, and I wondered why it is that I had to endure that. Where breathing was a fight. Why it is that I have the visual issues that I do. Why am I dyslexic? Why do I have the other visual impairments that I've got? Why is it that I had the other sicknesses that I had? Especially when I looked around, I'm just being honest with you here, especially when I looked around and it seemed that other people didn't ever deal with much, at least as it appeared to me. They seemed to be just fit as a fiddle all the time. And after a while, it got a little aggravating to me. But then I also think of Seneca, who's a Stoic philosopher. And one of the things that Seneca said was, if we took all of the evils in the world and we lumped them into a pile, we would probably be content to take our own and go home. Once we really factor in what people are going through, that we're completely unaware of what they're going through, right? We would probably be content to take our own and go home. It's food for thought, but I want to say this. Our not knowing all the good purposes God has for pain and suffering doesn't mean that there are no good purposes. Our not knowing, which is epistemology, what are the good purposes that God has for pain and suffering doesn't mean that there are no good purposes. And I also want to point something out. When it comes to the Christian story itself, at the center of the Christian story is the death of Jesus on the cross. So the idea that God is going to, you know, take incredible measures to deliver us from suffering is as foreign to the Bible as any idea that I think I've ever run across. Especially when I said is the centerpiece of our theology is suffering, but the defeat of it. That's the rest of the story. It's not just that they're suffering, it's the defeat of evil. Our not knowing doesn't mean that God, an infinite being, doesn't know. The only logical conclusion we can reach is that if God is all good and all knowing, then he must know the good purposes for the pain and suffering in the world. And we have to get to a place where maybe that's good enough for us. That God gives us the answers to the questions that we actually need the answers to. The ones that are going to help us. Because in fact, most of what we struggle with here is not intellectual. I'm not saying there are no intellectual concerns. There are. But primarily what it is that we struggle with is emotional. We don't know how to go through pain, and we don't know how to go through suffering well. This is why, for example, when we have someone in our church family pass away, one of the things that we try, assuming that they want this, one of the things that we try to offer to those families are books that help kind of guide them through how the kinds of feelings and experiences that they're going to have when they lose somebody that they really love. It's normal to our experience, but there's a healthy way of doing it. It also doesn't follow that evil proves that God is imperfect or limited. What follows is that we are imperfect and that we are limited. The other thing is have you ever realized that we have a tremendous, when you think about our capacity to understand things, it is limited. It really is. What we would like to think is if God just explained things, then that would be, oh, okay, I get it now. But it makes a huge assumption that even if God explained it, we would get it. And maybe we've overstated our ability to understand some things. Again, it's just food for thought. So when it comes to evil and suffering, we may not know about all of God's purposes, but you know what? We do know some of them. This isn't a complete mystery, even though there are moments of mystery. Some physical pain, by the way, for those of you that are note takers, let me just encourage you to scribble a few things down and ruminate on them, or let it marinate, whichever analogy you want. But here we go. All right. Some physical pain is necessary to develop character. Some physical pain is necessary to develop character. So, for example, I love this example that came from Norman Geisler. Sympathy is not achievable without misery, or patience without tribulation. Courage is unobtainable without fear, and endurance is occasioned only by hardship. In brief, some virtues would be totally absent without physical evil. Character building is only accomplished through affliction. And even Helen Keller, you probably remember her story, she said this, "Character cannot be developed in ease and quiet. Only through experience of trial and suffering can the soul be strengthened, vision cleared, ambition inspired, and success achieved." That's a great quote. C.S. Lewis, for those of you that have been around the church long enough, you've probably heard me quote him a time or two. But of the four cardinal virtues, which is wisdom, courage, temperance, and justice, but of the four cardinal virtues, C.S. Lewis considered courage to be a form not only of each of the other three, but of every virtue. Courage. Here's what he said. "Courage is not simply one of the virtues, but the form of every virtue at the testing point, which means at the point of highest reality. A chastity or honesty or mercy which yields to danger will be chaste or honest or merciful only on conditions." He goes on to say this, "Pilate was merciful till it became too risky." So when you think about courage, we think about these characteristics that we highly value, but where do they come from? Two ways of looking at this. Sometimes what God does is he uses our circumstances to forge our character. Sometimes he uses the circumstances to reveal our character. Some years ago, I'll give you this example, kind of just hit me. When I was a seminary student, and I had helped with a college ministry at a church in Fort Worth, and there was a shooting at the church. Made national news. To this day, I think of the senior pastor, he's now retired, named Al Meredith, whose plane was landing from Michigan. He had just done his mother's funeral. And he's landing only to find out that there are helicopters and TV towers all around his church because somebody had gone in and shot up the people. One of which was a college student that had given her life to Jesus, a TCU student. In her senior year, she gives her life to Jesus and ends up going to seminary, sitting to my left in a class on the book of Mark. One of the things that Al said, and this is something I want you to think about, he said, "You don't squeeze a lemon and get Dr. Pepper." You don't squeeze a lemon and get Dr. Pepper. You squeeze a lemon and you get lemonade. Here's the idea. Sometimes it's by the squeezing you find out what's really in you. And by finding out what's really in you, you find out what needs to change. Sometimes it reveals the character in us, and sometimes it reveals the lack of character in us. And that's a good. It's difficult, but it's a good. So that's the first thing. Here's the second thing. Some physical pain is necessary to teach individuals that certain types of behavior are wrong and have physical or moral consequences. Did you know that? The decision to invest in vices like pride or anger. For those of you who have been around the church, you know what I'm talking about right now, because we just finished the series on the seven deadly sins. Greed, gluttony, lust, sloth. These are manifestations of a person's refusal to master their impulses. They refuse to do it. But a failure to learn how to develop and use self-control will end up reducing interest in virtue and the desire to cultivate character. So what is it that is the best teacher? Parents, this is the hardest thing in the world, and it's to let your children to endure the choices, the consequences of the choices that they've made. Usually it is the consequences of the choices that are the best teacher that is there for the kids. And when parents always swoop in and remove it, the kid never learns. They never actually learn. Punishments are often necessary to teach individuals that they're stepping onto morally dangerous grounds. Only through the pain of discipline, sometimes, oftentimes, can we learn what self-control actually is. And that, by the way, is a good. Now again, while there are mysteries that surround the problem of evil and the problem of suffering, all I'm saying is there are some goods that we do know about. Now, let me give you a couple of more. Some pain is necessary to warn us of impending danger. Some pain is necessary to warn us of impending danger. It's like a warning system when you think about it. Philip Yancey has a book, and he it's really interesting because he talks about people in a leper colony. And he even works with one of the physicians whose name I'm totally blanking out on now. But he works with one of the physicians who had worked with people in a leper colony for years and years and years and years. Ultimately, that guy ends up getting leprosy. But here's the thing. People who have leprosy have participated in experiments in an effort to help keep them from causing themselves greater harm. One of the effects of leprosy is the loss of sensation in the extremities. And when someone with leprosy, like, inadvertently touches a scorching hot plate, or they cut off the tip of their finger with a saw or something like that, they're not going to feel the pain associated with those acts. And as a result, they may end up burning or mutilating themselves. In other words, they do more danger because the pain isn't there than if the pain were there. It goes to make the point. When you think about those experiments, researchers learned that in order for pain to properly serve its purpose and warn someone of danger, it had to be of the right intensity and out of that individual's control. And then it becomes a good teacher. The kind of research is encouraged to see pain as a blessing rather than just an affliction. It's interesting to me because what we like is we like for our nerve endings to be intact, especially when they're bringing us pleasure. However, when those same nerve endings are connected to something that doesn't bring us pleasure, we're like, I don't think I like those things very much. It shows us something about us, doesn't it? Next point. Some pain is necessary to help avoid greater suffering. So the pain of enduring sitting in a dentist's chair, which I'll admit I don't do very often, but the pain of enduring sitting in a dentist's chair is needed to keep you from suffering even greater pain. Let's go ahead and fill the cavity. That way you don't lose all of your teeth, for example. When someone ignores their health needs, like proper rest, diet, exercise, it's good that the body reacts the way that it does. It's telling us something about the choices that we're making. And it can keep us from a greater harm if we yield to it and just listen to it. Here's one other thought. Sometimes pain is what God uses just to get our moral attention. Sometimes pain is what God uses just to get our moral attention. C.S. Lewis, and I just wanted to quote him here. If you were to read The Problem of Pain, and I encourage all of you to go read it, he said, God whispers to us in our pleasures. He speaks to us in our conscience, but he shouts to us in our pains. It is his megaphone to rouse a morally deaf world. Until the evil man finds evil unmistakably present in his own existence in the form of pain, he is enclosed in illusion. No doubt pain as God's megaphone is a terrible instrument. It may lead to final and unrepentant rebellion, but it gives the only opportunity the bad man can have for amendment. It removes the veil. It plants the flag of truth within the fortress of a rebel soul. What a great quote. What it does show us is that even though God might be using these things to bring about circumstances whereby we become something that without suffering we wouldn't have been, even in the midst of World War II, and you think of all of the suffering of the Jews, and it wasn't just the Jews, when you think of the suffering of the church as well, One of the things that's interesting is all of the other stories that are relayed in the times of World War II. Because in spite of the fact that you had Hitler and you had all of the atrocities, one of the other things that people realized was there was also great good in the world as well. And much like what Lewis was saying, when he was an atheist and he looked at the world and the brokenness around it, and he said, I don't understand that if God exists, how the world could look like this. He said, but then I gave a reflection on my atheism. And I just thought, well, but if atheism is true, then I don't know where the good would have even come from to begin with. So even though he thought, well, maybe on the one hand, it seems that the believers have a problem of evil. He said, but the atheist not just has the problem of evil, we have the problem of explaining the good. Where would it even come from? And this is the last thing, at least for tonight, this is the last thing that I want to say. Sometimes what we do, especially with the problem of evil and the problem of suffering, is we get tunnel vision. I know I have. And here's what I mean by that, is that we become so focused on what it is that's in our experience that we don't want, that we lose the sight of all of the good things that we're taking for granted in that day. There's always more to the story. So much more to the story, in fact. Even though we're going to be turning to your questions, I want to kind of tip you off on where we're going. So here in a couple of weeks, so next week we're off, and the week after that on the 28th, I've invited Johnny Buckles, who's a member of our church, but also a professor of law at the University of Houston Law School. One of the questions that I wanted to deal with was the separation of church and state. Do not miss this. We're going to start at 7 o'clock sharp. So get your coffee and then come on in, because Johnny's going to be taking the stage. We have a lot to talk about that night. I know that you're going to enjoy it, but we also have more to talk about in terms of the problem of evil. I'm not done. I've just unpacked a number of things, and we're going to devote a whole night to the problem of hell, okay? Because for whatever it is that we say of the problem of suffering on this side of the ledger, it pales in comparison to what the doctrine of hell teaches. So here's the idea. If we can make some sense out of that, then certainly we can make some sense out of temporary and finite suffering on this side of things. Hopefully my comments tonight have at least gotten us down the road a little bit toward that. So I want to invite Melody to come out. Do we have some questions? Are they rolling? Good. Well, let me move this.
All right, guys.
And we'll get to them.
We had a lot of good questions last week, and
we did.
The questions are coming in, so head on over to menti.com. Remember that our code has changed, so our new code is 370426, and you can jump in on the conversation here. So, thank you, Alec.
Alec, you're a scholar and a gentleman. How many of you would like for Alec to do the Q&A tonight? Can I see your hands?
That's a great
All right,
idea.
Alec, come back. That was overwhelmingly in your favor.
All I'm saying is I'm glad that I'm the one asking the questions and you get to answer them.
Are they that bad tonight?
Well, you know.
Okay.
They're not bad. They're just...
Tough?
Tough.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. We're going to start off with an easy one.
Okay.
This one came up last week and we didn't get to it, so here's kind of another way to view it. Okay. Sorry, hold on. Okay. Why did God allow Nazis to exterminate the Jews? What good could come from that?
What good come from the extermination of the Jews? Okay, so one, start with where I started tonight. We can never underestimate the significance and the value of free will. I'm not saying that's everything. I'm reminding you that it is something. If God exists, just so it say if God exists and he endows us with this capacity of choice, then one of the things that we have to bear in mind is that that with that, there's the other side of the coin, right? That there is the option to reject, there's the option to accept. I think that is a part of the story. The other thing is this, especially if you bear in mind everything else that I was talking about here. You know, when you have something like a Hitler that rises up, or you could think of, you know, Pol Pot, you could think of others, right? Here's the thing. You see the rest of the world rising up and affirming that this is not the way that the world ought to be. You see people rising up and saying, this is not the way that the world ought to be, which, by the way, is good. It's good insofar as people are recognizing it. When we're trying to talk about what good can come out of this, there are a number of goods that people have seen. One is people found God in it. People found God in it. They were making judgments about the way that the world should and should not be and realized that it had gone off the mark. That's a good thing. All the while, there was tremendous suffering, you know, to be, you know, that was certainly had. That's definitely a part of the story. When you think of other facets, you know, sometimes what you find is that people are basically in a moral slumber. People are just walking like moral zombies. And you see some moments like this that rise up, that awaken something that otherwise was dead in people. What I'm not saying is that God causes Hitler to come about so that those things can happen. What I'm trying to say is Hitler comes about, and then God uses those things or those people, much like you see characters in the Bible, to bring about a good in spite of people like a Hitler. Do you see the difference between the two? There's also something that I think is implied here, and I want you to hear what I'm saying, because if, number one, if the question here really is emotional in nature, then there's nothing rational is actually going to help. I'm convinced of that. If the issue is not intellectual in nature, and it's more emotional in nature, then you have to approach it in a completely different, you have to approach it in a completely different way. But I think that there's more to what's going on here, especially when you look at something like, you know, genocide that's happened around the world and so forth, is when you see that God works in spite of people, what it shows is that there is an extraordinary capacity in us for evil. And I also want to point out that it's good that we see that. So much like one of the things that I was bringing up here, it is one of the best teachers that we have to the broken state that we're in. And God has good reason. How deep does the rabbit hole go when it comes to sin? And the answer is, without the restraining hand of God, it's basically unlimited. How deep can depravity go? And the answer is really deep. And God has good reasons for allowing these things to happen for us to see what's in us. But again, remember the rest of the story, right? You have people that rise up, that counteract evil, that fight against it. You have the confessing church in Germany that's stepping up against the state, like the Dietrich Bonhoeffers. Again, there's always more to the story, always more to the story.
Well, and I think that's one of the best examples of the depravity of man that we see exemplified in our history. And so, you know, it's easy to kind of go to that as a good example of fighting that sense of evil.
Sure.
But here's a good extension. The question is, if we might be able to understand why God allows evil on this earth, or even if God explained it to us, why didn't God give us a mind to understand his reasoning?
Why didn't God give us a mind to understand his reasoning? I think God did give us a mind to understand some of it. That was some of the stuff that I was unpacking tonight. So while there are some things about God, his ways are going to be, your ways are not our ways, and that's part of the problem. We value things differently, and as a result of valuing things differently, we see things differently. By the way, I'm no different, and I'm on the team, right? I mean, I'm a believer. So his ways are not our ways. But that's completely different than saying we can't understand anything that God is doing. And that's why I was trying to point out some of the things that I was pointing out tonight. Look, if you think of what's sometimes called a natural law theodicy, and it's that God has created the world and he's endowed it with certain natural laws so that there's a certain regularity to the way that the world works. And there's a great good in that. So, you know, when I went to cook, chicken fried steak last night for, especially my two oldest girls, but, you know, I go to cook chicken fried steak last night, I got to tell you, it's good that fire behaves the way that it does. Otherwise, it'd be a little bit difficult to cook the meat. However, it's when we put our hand in the fire that we have a problem with fire. We want it to have different properties when it harms us than the properties that it has when we're using it for heat and for cooking. But fire is just fire. Does that make sense? And the reason that I bring that up, and this gets to a different question, you know, you say, well, why doesn't God intervene? And the point is, we're asking for God to do miracles quite regularly. In fact, a ton every day. Now, what's the frequency of a miracle? I'm going to tell you, for biblical reasons, I think that they're going to be altogether somewhat infrequent. God's not going to be handing these things out like candy. And one of the reasons that I say that is because even if you look at Luke's gospel, you know, Jesus goes into a village. It says great throngs of people were coming to Jesus, and they were sick, and they came to Jesus to be healed. And it says, and he healed some, and he went on. It doesn't say he healed all of them. It says he healed some, and then he moved on. Now, again, this goes back to what our expectations should be in the here and now. And our expectations should be what Jesus said that they are going to be. In this world, you will have trouble. You will have trouble. So what are my expectations when I wake up on a Monday morning? I might have trouble today. I might have trouble on a Tuesday. I might die on a Thursday. Okay, so I accept that. So kind of all connected in here, there's this conglomeration of goods that God says when he created the world, he gave it certain properties, certain capacities. We like the benefits and we hate the drawbacks. We hate the drawbacks to it. And that's why I was giving the example earlier. You know, we love the nerve endings, especially when they're connected to pleasure, and we hate them when they're connected to pain, even though we know that there are times where pain is good for us. It's good for us. Even if it's pain as a moral teacher, pain in terms of what's good for my body, there's a whole list of things. So I don't think that God has left us no witness. I don't think that. I think he's left us some. Peter Kraft, who's a professor of philosophy up at Boston College, one of the things that Peter Kraft said is that God always gives us just enough so that we can see that he is there without giving us so much that it's overbearing to us. Does that make some sense?
Yeah.
And I think that there's a lot of wisdom. I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. God gives us what we need. And that includes our understanding. Paul Mosher is a professor at University of Loyola in Chicago. And one of the things that he said that I thought was really insightful, he said, you know, God is not very patient with our idols. And one of the idols that we have are what he called cognitive idols. And that God is there to answer my curiosity to the crud that's happening in the world. And if he doesn't do it, what? He said, you know, actually, God might have good reasons for withholding some things because you're viewing your questions the wrong way and you're holding your question above him in a way that you can't hold anything above him. He has good reasons for withholding that from you. Why? It's one way of crushing the idol. It's an interesting thought. You might have to go chew on that a little bit, but actually, I had to go chew on that a little bit when I first read it. I was like, I don't know. But I think it may go to the question. All right, we probably have some more, so let's go.
Oh, just a few.
Okay.
Okay, so if it's really hard for us to wrap our mind around evil and suffering and why God does what he does, and, you know, even though we have some way of understanding this, we're not God. We don't see his reasons. So should one pray that their enemies or evil be destroyed?
Yeah, why not?
But why?
Why not? Look, one, it's the natural heart cry of a person that sees the brokenness of the world. If you look at the Psalms, they're what are called imprecatory Psalms, and you may sit there and go, I have no idea what that is. Oh, yes, you do. You know, if you ever read a Psalm where it's like, you know, smite my enemy with your fist and break their jaw, that's an imprecatory Psalm. Now, here's the thing. I'm not telling you like tonight to go and pray that prayer, right? You know, Bob at work has really become a thorn. And so, you know, I'd ask, Lord, that you strike him in the jaw and crush his jaw, you know, or cave his face in. What those Psalms do show us is that is what is coming out of us. It's not, does that make sense? Because of the brokenness, because of the hurt, this is exactly what we feel. And that's the beauty of those Psalms. They are raw and they are honest. I think God is fully expecting us to say some things like that. Fully expecting it. All the while he's up there saying, I'm the one that will determine when judgment is rendered, not you. So it can be a manifestation of a heart cry, all the while saying, hopefully saying, I'm going to trust your time and your way. Look, it's like we were talking about this morning and even over the last several weeks, because everybody, you know, I know I made the joke this morning. Some people came up and they're like, that was funny, you know, because the Canaanites came up this morning, right? And it was the thing. I was like, oh, all these people are loving the Canaanites. You know, oh, those poor Canaanites. But if you're on the receiving end of the wickedness of the Canaanites, you're asking a completely different question. And it's, how long do we have to suffer? This is the thing that we hold in a balance here. And this is something that I would even ask of people that have given their heart to Jesus. How patient are you willing to be so that God can extend the grace and the mercy of the gospel to a person that you think is beyond it? How patient are you willing to be? What that means is that there's probably a tremendous amount of suffering that's going to be endured until, if you look in Scripture, till God says, and your sin has reached its full measure and it's over. Now, at that time, folks, it's over. But I want to hasten to point something out. Delayed justice is still justice. It's still justice. So what is the chief end of man? The Westminster Shorter Catechism begins by saying is to know God and to enjoy him forever. Why are we created? We're created to know God and to enjoy him forever. Forever. And what that may mean is there are some times where God is incredibly patient. With the Canaanites, that's why I was saying, you know, functionally he gives them four generations. You're talking 400 years of captivity of the Israelites in Egypt, all the while they are where they are. And God is all the while saying, turn and repent, turn and repent, turn and repent. And they don't, and they don't do it. But he gets to the point where he says, time's up, time's up. And at that point, I don't want to be a Canaanite. Because what they will know, there's more than one way. There's more than one way to be reconciled with God. There's more than one way. And what I mean by that is this. Even for the person that has persisted in their rejection of Jesus, can be reconciled that the verdict that God renders against them is correct when the case is made. There will be no doubt. Why the verdict is made and why they are separated from him, I think there would be no doubt. So even though there may not be a relational reconciliation, there can certainly be a judicial reconciliation. But God's patient. By the way, we're not, right?
Really?
Did you know that?
I'm incredibly patient.
We are not. So food for thought.
Okay. So one of these fine folk here say, I hear and I understand everything you're saying, but I still struggle emotionally with suffering or even bad things happening to innocent children.
Sure.
Can you help us wrap not only our minds, but our hearts around evil happening to innocent children?
Sure. Can I start by saying if your issue really is emotional, then what you need is pastoral care. I'm not being cute. Then what you need is pastoral care and you need counseling. Even scholars will pull those things apart. Alvin Plantinga, who wrote a book called God, Freedom, and Evil, and one of the things that he says at the end of the book is we have to pull the intellectual and the pastoral questions apart. And if what's going, and this is one of the greatest minds of the last 100 years, one of the greatest minds of the last 100 years, and he said, if what is going on here is primarily pastoral, then you need to have a good pastor that walks alongside, that comforts and helps. This, by the way, is the story of Job. This is the story of Job, that rather than getting an answer to the question why, he had the presence of God, and that was sufficient. Now, what I always encourage our church to do is to walk alongside people that, as they suffer, to help meet the physical needs as they suffer, to pray with and to encourage as they suffer, and to realize there's the hope of restoration and redemption beyond a broken world. That's what we're supposed to do and be as a church. So serious, I'm not being cute. If the issue is on an emotional level, the intellectual things aren't going to help you. But when you see, so I had a friend that posted something just yesterday. And when I saw it, I have to tell you, it broke me. Because it's a friend of mine in North Carolina. And they were making the decision about one of their kids who was 5 years old. And they realized that the cancer treatments are not working. She's in too much pain. And they've said, we're going to hand her over to Jesus. Now, when I saw the thread, I got upset. And that's the way I should react. That's exactly how I should react. But we also bear in mind that going back into the fall in Genesis chapter 3, one of the things that we know is we have inherited the consequences of Adam's sin. And what that means is that we have inherited the brokenness of the world full bore, full stop. What I see is, and I've talked about this before, so I'm not gonna unpack this because I've already unpacked it when we dealt with the destiny of the unevangelized. But I have the full confidence that for every kid that never reaches the state of accountability, one of the things that they enjoy, for whatever suffering, albeit finite, it's finite in length, it is finite in intensity, but I'm convinced that for every kid that does not reach the state of accountability, they participate in an endless joy of knowing Jesus face to face, face to face. Marilyn McCord Adams, who's written extensively on the problem of evil, and she and I had an exchange about this when I was teaching up in Wake Forest, and one of the things that she said, and as we were talking, was I said, so here's what I want to hear from you. What that means is that what God does in restoring that child and bringing that child into his presence pales in comparison to the amount of suffering that that child would have endured. And she said, absolutely. And so I said, now crudely speaking, and the trade-off is worth it. It's worth it. And she said, heaven is worth everything. Heaven is worth everything. So when I look at the suffering of children, I think I'm with everybody else because as upset as I got from seeing the post from a friend of mine, which was very upset, one of the things that I know is that God is sovereign. He is in control. Nothing about her circumstances caught him off guard. And there is a good that he has in mind to bless that little girl. Fully convinced of that by the testimony of his word. Of his word. And I take comfort in that.
That's a really tough question to unpack.
Of course it is.
Okay, so with all of this considered, how should a Christian confront pain in someone else who is hurting and seeking comfort? Should we approach them with hard truth or with sympathy? How do we balance those two things?
Yeah, I would encourage the sympathy move. So, you know, some years ago, when I was in high school, there was an accident that ended up killing a number of my friends. I remember the father of one of the girls that died, and he was talking to my dad, actually. And this was only months after the fact, but one of the things that he said, you know, I just want to know why it happened. Well, here was the thing. Right at the time when she passed away, he wasn't wanting to know why. He was just hurting. The reason that I focus on sympathy is because that's really primarily what's going on. You know, how do we process grief on that level? How do we do that? Frankly, most of us don't know. And that's the problem. It's also the challenge of the church to try to help people to know and to prepare us for those circumstances of life and how we walk alongside people in those circumstances. If our churches aren't even making an effort to do that, then our churches are failing our people. So let's start there. This is also why, for example, here we have Stephen Ministry. And one of the things that we encourage people to do is to have someone to walk alongside people in difficult times. We don't provide these people to say, by the way, here's your professional counselor, right? Instead, what we say is this is a person that's going to pray with you and to walk through life with you. Isn't that the story of Job? I think it is. And so we try to provide something like that. That is tangible and practical ways of meeting people where they are. Rather than saying, you know, here's an abstract possibility that might apply to you in this time of crisis. Because here's the thing, we're not exactly sure if the issue is intellectual, which one it is. And honestly, in over 20 years of pastoral ministry, and even writing a book on the problem of evil, here's the thing that I found from people. They aren't necessarily sure when it's an intellectual, which one it is. They aren't even sure. So it goes to this. One, we have to set our expectations the way that Jesus says to set our expectations. In this world, you'll have trouble. So what should I expect? Trouble. But take heart, I've overcome the world. There's the rest of the story. I've overcome the world. It's food for thought.
All right, so this question says, I tend to think of sinfulness and evil as two separate things. Is there any biblical distinction between the two?
Is there any biblical distinction between sin and evil?
Yes.
Well, they're certainly related, right? If you take some of the distinctions that I've used before, which, you know, really just goes back to the original language, so where sin and transgression and perversion, they're related, but they're distinct. You know, sometimes we have these sins that are sins of what are called omission. We just, you know, we passed over something. Even Psalm 58 highlights, a mistake that was basically born out of ignorance, right? So those are real things. However, you look at Psalm 51, what does David say? You know, against your law have I transgressed. So when he's looking at Bathsheba, he's not sitting there going, yeah, so is this cool? The answer is no, and did he know it? And the answer was yes, he knew it. That's a transgression, which is a type of sin. It's a willful disobedience against God. But then you think of perversion. And the way that Paul describes perversion is it's almost like an effect that our choices have on us, where it takes our disposition and it makes it crooked. It literally just bends it. It takes what's straight and goes, and it bends it. So are evil and sin literally identical? The answer is no, but those things are related. If you take the Augustinian view of evil, which I've kind of told you what it is, it's a privation of goodness. It's a lack of goodness in a substance or a created thing, right? Here's what that would mean. It's almost like evil is the effect, like rust on a car or depravity in your soul. And the cause of it is sin. It's what brings about the decay that's inside of us. So will we treat them identically? Not if you take the Augustinian view. But would you say that there's a relationship between the two? And the answer is absolutely you would.
All right, so technically we're out of time, but there's just this one question that I really feel like you're going to enjoy answering.
So. Is it your question?
No.
Okay. All right.
I just think it's a good question.
Well, the way you're looking at me, I'm like, all right, you've got one. All right, go ahead.
This is just something that I think you'll have fun unpacking a little bit, and I want to hear what your answer is. Okay.
Okay.
So why use philosophy to explain our world when everything God wants us to know is from the Bible and from His Word?
Right. So why use philosophy? One, what is philosophy? You might want to start there. And all of you are doing it. The question is are you doing it well? Not are you doing it? You are. That was actually one of the coolest things in talking with the people at Rice. I got at a table. They were all doctoral students. None of them would be interviewed, by the way. So I was like, fine. So I just sit down with them. One of them is a PhD in chemistry. And, he goes, well, you know, I do things that are a lot more tangible than what you did as you were doing your PhD in philosophy. I said, well, that's interesting, because I bet every day you'd use philosophy as you do chemistry. And he goes, no, I don't think I do. And I said, okay, well, is there any value in what you're doing? And he said, yeah. I said, well, welcome to philosophy. It took like one question, right? Do you try to explain things as you do chemistry? Yeah, welcome to philosophy. You're using a certain model of explanation, right? He goes, okay, fair enough. Here's the thing. Philosophy is the study of metaphysics, which is the study of what is ultimate reality. Christianity has something to say about that. Philosophy is the study of epistemology, which is how do we know something? Christianity has something to say about that. The whole theme of the book of 1 John, there's this phrase in the Greek, that you may know, that you may know. So epistemology, the study of knowledge, Christianity has something to say about that. The third major area is value theory. There are three different parts of value theory. One is social and political theory. Is there a right form of government? The answer is yes. I'm just not doing that tonight. All right. How about ethics? Anybody study ethics? I think that Christianity has something to say about ethics. And then aesthetics, which is the study of beauty and art and so forth. Is beauty just in the eye of the beholder, or is it objective and we discover it? Christianity has a lot to say about that, right? So there's that. And then logic, which is the principles of rightly ordered reasoning and thinking. All of these things. So when you think about Christianity uses all of those things. When Paul, at the beginning of 1 Corinthians, he says, avoid vain philosophy. I agree with him. Avoid the vain kind. You know, Jesus also says to avoid vain prayer, but I don't see anybody saying don't pray. And let's remember, at the end of 1 Corinthians, he says that at the beginning, and at the end of 1 Corinthians, the same Apostle Paul in the 15th chapter makes arguments for the resurrection of Jesus, same guy. The same guy. So I'm trying to give an answer to the question to say, you can't avoid it. Everybody's doing it. What you want to do is you want to do philosophy under the cross. That's what you want to do. You want to put philosophy under Jesus, because the word itself just means the love of wisdom. That's what it means. So don't pull those two things apart. The other thing that I would also suggest is there are a number of things to which Scripture doesn't speak. Have you figured that out yet? Otherwise, why would we even be here? There are a number of things to which Scripture doesn't directly speak. I've said this before. What are the mechanics of creation? Genesis does not tell you. It does not tell you. Genesis 1 and 2 does not tell you how God did it. It tells you that God did it. It's about the who. That's what it's about. Who did it? He did it. How? He doesn't tell you. But maybe there are some ways that science can help us there. I'm letting you into my world a little bit here. That's at least the way that I think. And I think that's a good thing, so long as we're putting it under the cross, right? That's a good thing. So I hope that that answers the question at least a little bit. Because if you look at Job, there's no theodicy there. If you look at the example of Scripture, when it's like, hey, why is Pilate and the suffering of the innocents and so forth? Great time for Jesus to say, here, I'll tell you why he doesn't do it. Why is that? Maybe because Jesus understands something better than we do. We're asking the wrong questions a lot of times, and as a result, we're getting the wrong answers. And by that, here's what I mean. Even if he gave us the answer, it wouldn't really even satisfy us. It just wouldn't. Which is why when we began this conversation a week ago, I gave the example of the woman whose daughter had killed herself. And about a year later, I'm sitting down and talking with her. And she asked the question, why? And I said, Jesus gives you the why. Are you good? Are you good? To her credit, she said, nope, I'm not good. I just want my daughter back. I said, okay. That, by the way, is the gospel. That's the gospel. That one day you might. It's a good way to end tonight. Because I'm mentally tired.
See, I thought he might have a thing or two to say on that one.
Yeah, I got more to say, but hey, that's where I'm stopping. You know why? Because the Rockets are playing in 25 minutes. You know?
It would be
a great evil if I missed that. That is not the way that the world ought to be.
Much suffering would occur.
Much suffering. Yeah, that's right.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about Veritas, visit us at www.veritaswbc.com.